Blog Talk Radio.
Eastern Airlines, the Eastern Radio Show, where we come to you each Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Our regular hosts are Steve Thompson, Margaret Bars, Howard Mucci, George Jin, Jim Graybill, Neil Holland, and me, Chuck Albright. Our hosts, who have followed our show, are scattered from South Florida, Martha's Vineyard, North Florida, North Carolina, New York, Kentucky, and where I live in Central Florida, a beautiful retirement community called The Villages. Now, to be with us live with your comments, remember, call into the show using our phone number at area code 213-816-1611. I'll repeat that. Area code 213-816-1611. Be sure to press the number 1 on your phone keypad. Connect live. Otherwise, you'll just be listening to the show over your phone. It's easier just to listen by going to our website at www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. Let me do that again. www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. Neil, will you tell us about tonight's show?
Yes, Chuck. Thanks so much. For our listeners out there, we're getting more and more popular as we broadcast each week, every Monday. We're picking up more listeners and more countries. We're now over 40 countries, close to 50 countries around the world that listen to us now. So we're very happy about that. Our ratings are, I guess we could call our ratings pretty good. It's mainly about Eastern Airlines, our shows, although we do vary them from time to time and bring up interesting topics that we feel our listeners might want to hear. But just to say again what Chuck gave you, our listeners, our phone number, it's easy to tune us in, first of all. Just go to the website that Chuck gave, blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. Yes, that's named after Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, so we just use the shortened version, CaptEddie. And there you'll be able to see a radio icon. Just click it on, especially if you tune in at 7 o'clock, a little bit after 7 o'clock, you will see the red letters that says On the Air. Hey, just like the real folks, real broadcast stations. But just click on that, and you'll come right into our radio show. And if you'd like to make a comment, don't forget, you've got to press that 1 on your keypad, and that will make us aware that you have a comment and you want to join in our conversation. We'd welcome you. Also, you can go to our website for our members of the Radio Club. It's EALRadioClub.com. Just go to www.EALRadioClub.com. And there you will also see the radio icon, and just click on the little button that has the arrow, and that will make it live for you. You can pick out the last 5 shows on the face of the radio. It indicates the last 5 shows that we have broadcast. And if you go to Blog Talk Radio, you'll be able to see all 124th with this broadcast. It's our 124th broadcast. I looked it up. I divided by 52, 124, and I got 2.38 something, something, something. So we're pretty close to 2.25 years of broadcasting. Two and a third, I guess, what I should say. We do have a lot of programs there. And on our website, we have a description of each one of the broadcasts. So you can go back in the archive and listen to that show that might be of interest to you. We have fun doing this show, and I'm sure all of our hosts will agree that it's kind of fun to come back every Monday and, again, talk about our favorite subject, Eastern Airlines. We mention it many, many times during our broadcast, and folks want to hear news about the airline, what's happened to it, and hopefully in the future we can get the new president of Eastern Airlines, the corporation, and have him come back. He's been on our show about 3 times in the past, and so maybe we can get him back to be on our show. This week we couldn't help but make comments about a reporter writing about the best planes manufactured by Boeing. First of all, my thoughts about Boeing, I don't think there's an airplane in the air that's built any better than Boeing aircraft. I've always been partial to Boeings, having flown the 727 and the 757. I just think they're great airplanes. I never did fly the Boeing 720 that Eastern had, but we do have some thoughts about the Boeing, the best of Boeing's aircraft, as told by this writer for the Motley Fool newspaper. Steve, why don't you start us off in this report?
Thanks, Neil, but I want everyone to beware. I suspect this article will please precisely no one, so consider yourself forewarned. It was written by Rich Smith, dated July 20th, 2013. And the title is 7 Civilian Airplanes That Made Boeing Great. After 2 weeks that have seen two Boeing airplanes left burning on the tarmac, I've been asked to remind investors of the bigger picture at Boeing, to pin a piece on the 7 airplanes that made Boeing great. Now, of course, boiling down to the history of century-old plane builder to just 7 important models must be an exercise in triage. Do we limit our choices to Boeing or qua Boeing? Or do McDonnell Douglas or even just Douglas birds deserve to roost among these rankings? Sure, why not? Do we count military warplanes in addition to the civil airliners? No, at least not in today's column. And how far back in time shall we search for the roots of Boeing's greatness? And how far into the future dare we guess its success may reach? The only certainty is anyone who knows Boeing at all is going to disagree with at least some of these choices. Well, so be it. Without further ado, here are my nominations for 7 planes that made Boeing a great company, and that gives us some assurance the company has the staying power to remain great despite its recent setbacks. Well, the Boeing 80. It was first flown in 1928. The Model 80 was the plane that got Boeing off the ground. It was the company's first airplane built specifically for passenger transport, carrying first a dozen passengers, then later upgraded to a Model 80A-1, which could carry 18. It was a plane Boeing built to compete with rival passenger aircraft from Fokker and, if you believe it, Ford. And it eventually came the first airplane with a stewardess on board to hand out refreshments. A registered nurse, Ellen Church, landed the first stewardess berth in 1930. It is reconfigured 80A-1 iteration, and Model 80 supported a 40 an 80-foot wingspan and could fly as far as 460 miles. Chuck, can you tell us about the Boeing 314?
Well, perception is a powerful thing. When selling an airplane to an airline, there can hardly be a more potent marketing tool than a line like this. And did you know that this plane was picked by the president to fly on? Well, in 1943, in the middle of World War II, President Franklin D. Roosevelt flew to Casablanca aboard the Dixie Clipper, a Boeing 314, making the 314 effectively the first Air Force One. They really didn't call it that, of course, not least because at that time, the U.S. didn't actually have an Air Force. The Boeing 314 enjoyed some commercial success as well. It was first flown in 1938, and 12 of the planes were built before World War II broke out. Designed to the specifications for Pan American World Airways as a flying boat, capable of carrying passengers to Europe, the 314 could carry 74 passengers in style and boasted a flight range of 3,500 miles. With a wingspan of 152 feet, the deep-chested 314 was more than twice as big as the Model 80. Howard, do you have some comment?
Hey there, just a minute. The DC-3 was built by Douglas Aircraft. Is this a mistake by the writer? Sometimes, great mergers can create even greater companies. If you've ever wondered why McDonnell Aircraft bought Douglas Aircraft in 1967, or why Boeing merged with McDonnell Douglas 30 years later, the answer can be summed up in one hyphenated word, the DC-3. It wasn't as big as the Boeing 314. With a smaller wingspan and a shorter range, yet Boeing modestly calls the DC-3, first flown in 1935, the greatest airplane of its time, and perhaps the greatest of all time. Many people agree with this assessment. Originally built for American Airlines, the plane soon gained a fan in United Airlines as well, and then it went on to win sales contracts with nearly three dozen airlines, and an alliance with its DC-2 predecessor captured more than 90% of the aircraft air passenger market. The DC-3 carried 28 passengers, or slept 14, which doesn't sound like much in today's terms. However, it was the first plane capable of carrying enough passengers, and with its fuel efficiency, it was able to earn the airline owners a profit. A final testament to the plane's quality is the fact that hundreds of DC-3s are still flying today, nearly four score years after the plane was first built.
I might add a comment to that also, Howard, that the DC-3 of Eastern Airlines hangs in the Washington Smithsonian Institute. Steve, how about the jet airplanes?
Yes, and the Boeing 707, we all know about it. It was built around the bones of the KC-135, which is a military aerial refueling tanker, in 1957. The Boeing 707 got off to a troubled start, not all that unlike with the 787 today. Boeing made a lot of big bets on the 707. Those bets came to define the company and the industry in time. For example, the 707 standardized Boeing and industry practice of putting the passenger door on the left side of the plane and installing doors both fore and aft. Boeing also gambled big on customizing the base model plane, 130-foot wingspan, 3,000-mile range, to the requirements of multiple customers. It built longer-range models for far-off Australian Qantas Airways, and it tweaked the plane to accept bigger engines for high-altitude flights among South American airlines. This was quite a change from the old practice of drawing up entirely new airplanes at the request of individual customers such as American and United. Such tweaks cost some money, sure, but they also helped Boeing grab market share from rival Douglas Aircraft. Ultimately, Boeing sold 856 of these airplanes. Chuck.
Well, the Boeing 737, 46 years young, still going strong. Our next entry into the Boeing best plane list is a no-brainer. The Boeing 737 was 93.7 feet long with a 93-foot wingspan. The original 737 was nicknamed the Square. For its nearly equal measurements, it flew 1,115 miles on a full tank of gas and carried as many as 107 passengers. Later versions ran up through today, 737 Next Generation and 737 Max Iterations can carry as many as twice that number. Currently en route to deliver well over 10,000 airplanes, with more than 7,000 already in the hands of its customers, the 737 is the most successful commercial airplane ever built. Now in its fifth decade of production, the 737 remains so popular that Boeing is quite literally cannot build the planes fast enough to keep up with demand. Jim?
Yeah, but the old saying, if it ain't Boeing, I ain't going. Boeing designed and built the world's first jumbo jet in just 16 months and then got it in air in 1969. Perhaps Boeing's most iconic airplane, the first Boeing 747, stood six stories tall. It weighed nearly 370 tons. It was also the biggest Boeing and had the new fabric to build it with. The existing workplace is just didn't fit. For nearly 40 years, it was the world's largest passenger jet, carrying as many as 550 passengers on flights as long as 6,000 miles. Needless to say, it's still flying today, and in fact, just the last week or so, Boeing sold two more of these aircraft. Steve?
The Boeing 777, we've heard an awful lot about that lately, and it's last but not least, and really not even last. We'll end this list with the plane that inspired it, the Boeing 777, which crash-landed and caught fire in San Francisco International Airport last weekend. Yet so well built that it managed to keep all but two passengers alive through the crash out of hundreds aboard. How great is this 777? And how helpful is its reputation to Boeing? It's great enough that the recent crash was only the second significant accident recorded in the 777's 18-year history. Great enough that, according to famed Captain Chelsea Sully Sullenberger, last weekend was the only recorded instance in which a passenger aboard a 777 died. And that's great enough to have persuaded Boeing customers to line up and buy 1,100 777s over the years. The biggest twin-engine commercial jet in the world, the 777 was Boeing's first plane to be designed entirely on computer using 3D graphics. Its sports wings spanning nearly 200 feet and a range of upwards of 8,000 miles and the capacity to haul up to 440 passengers, more than one-third of the way around the Earth before it needed to refuel. Chuck.
The writer of this article for Motley Fool added the following comments from its foolish readers. Help us keep this at a respectable foolish area. This is the place for our readers to discuss, debate, learn more about the foolish investing topics to read about than we have above. Help us keep it clean and safe. If you believe a comment are abusive or otherwise violates our foolish rules, please report it via report this comment on July 20th, 2013 at 7:36 a.m. This person wrote, the DC-3 came along 60 years before Boeing's merger, and Boeing really had nothing in the short, medium-range segment until the 727, which definitely should have been on the list. In 1963, the 727 opened the mainstream jet market to runways that could never accommodate the earlier, larger four-engine jets. Also, the 757, 767 lines inspired the long-range twin-engine craze that's with us today, and it's here to stay. Back in the 80s, the 737 could only fly about 1,500 miles nonstop, and the A300 was still a wide-body niche in the product. The 757 and the 767, all the competitors that followed reduced cabin crews to two, were quiet and they were efficient, very safe by any means and measures, brought cockpit instruments into the electronics age. All of the above can be seen in the newer 737s, 777, 787, the Airbus 320, and newer and even regional jets with all their stripes. Jim?
Yeah, report this comment on July 20th, 2013 at 7:48 a.m. wrote, being an aviation historian, I enjoyed the article, but having to nitpick on this on something, the great Boeing 707 was not delivered from the KC-135 tanker. Rather, they were both from the Boeing Dash 80. Projected with first flew in 1954 after Boeing saw the need to complete with the de Havilland Comet, the first jet airliner. The story goes that Boeing President Bill Allen set up a demonstration of the Dash 80 for airline industry leaders. During that demo flight, Boeing test pilot Tuck Johnson sent CEO Allen into a near rage when he did two barrel rolls with the big four-engine jet. However, Bill's aircraft owner, Larry Bell, saw Allen's displeasure and said to him, Bill, you don't know the Tex very well. You don't know Tex very well. He just sold your airplane for you. Almost the next day, the orders started doubling and flooding in. Steve?
Yeah, report this comment on July 20th, 2013, at 7:45 a.m., wrote, completely left out of the article is the manufacturer of the engines for all initial production models of these airplanes, which would not have ever flown without the cutting-edge engineering by the engineers at Pratt & Whitney Aircraft Corporation in East Hartford, Connecticut. Equally, Boeing Airframes, Pratt & Whitney needs recognition in conjunction with the honor bestowed. And Chuck.
And the final comment, reported this comment on July 20th, 2013, at 9:34 a.m., he wrote, the DC and DC-3 stands for Douglas Corporation, which later became McDonnell Douglas, and has since been merged into Boeing. The DC-3 does belong on the list of the top 10 planes. It does not belong on a list of Boeing's top 10, as it was never manufactured by Boeing or at any Boeing plant during World War II. Boeing 707 is and forever will be the world's greatest leap into aviation. This is followed very closely by the Boeing 747, two planes that forever live and won the hearts and minds of the flying public like no other. The greatest 707 ever fly, the most beautiful 707 to ever land in any airport, was with tail number SAM-2600. It was Air Force One. One looked at that plane and you knew the most powerful man in the world had just arrived. Neil?
Well, interesting report, guys, and I think the writer should have gone back, in my opinion. Of course, he had some great airplanes that he mentioned there, and undoubtedly they have been very popular over the years and have made Boeing as strong a manufacturer as any aircraft manufacturer in the world. In fact, I believe Boeing and Airbus are about the only two major large commercial airline manufacturers, but to leave out the Boeing 727, I think it's a mistake, like one of the people that wrote in about that report. I think that deserves a definite place. And I always thought the 727 was a DC-3 of the jet age. What's your thoughts, Steve, and some of the hosts, the other hosts?
Well, about the DC-3, I have a real fond place in my heart for that airplane. I had over 2,000 hours in it.
Wow.
And if knowing what I know and having flown all of the airplanes that I have flown, if somebody came to me and said, okay, we want you to design a training program that will produce one of produce the best pilots who have ever flown airplanes, I would include an amount of time, say no less than 50 hours of flying time in a DC-3 for these pilots to attain such a high level of competency. Anybody else have a comment on the DC-3?
Steve, why do you say that the DC-3 would be required in a person's flying education, so to say? What makes a DC-3 such that you would put it in the training of future pilots or pilots as far as the training curriculum? Why?
Well, because unlike tricycle gear airplanes, you have to use the rudder almost constantly, especially on the ground. And you have to use the flight controls in the true fashion that Orville and Wilbur Wright designed airplanes for, and that's to use your hands and feet all in coordination with each other to keep an airplane in the space that it should be kept in.
I think, it's kind of like playing a piano, isn't it, with your left and right hands with the white keys and the red key, the black keys, rather. And then
yes,
the foot pedals to add a little harmony there. I'm glad you said that, because the tailwheel airplanes really taught, I think, a pilot really how to fly an airplane. And especially when you're rolling down that runway and you don't have any forward visibility with a DC-3 with a tailwheel airplane, to get that tail up as quickly as possible so you can see the runway in front of you. And also you learn a great deal about such aerodynamic elements such as torque and what it does on an airplane. So I think you're right in saying that should be in every pilot's training curriculum. Not necessarily does it have to be a DC-3, because there are other tailwheel airplanes, but the DC-3 was a fabulous airplane, no doubt.
Yeah.
Jim, what's your thoughts?
I agree with you guys on the tail dragger guys. You get in any tail dragger airplane, even the J3 Cub or Ronica 7AC, and that tail wheel is going to make a believer out of you with those rudder pedals on this airplane for. I agree with you. What you said there, Neil, too. I think the 727, out of all the commercial airliners I've flown, I feel more comfortable today in a 727 than any airplane I've ever flown. Of course, I wouldn't do it, or probably couldn't do it, but I feel like I can go out there and jump in the left seat or the right seat of a 727 and zoom, off and going. It's just,
Jim, you're right. I feel like today, as a matter of fact, I do a lot of 727 flying in my dreams, but it seems like the Boeing airplanes are simple, really simple. It's not the stick off to the left like Airbus does and still does, and I don't think Boeing has accepted that new radical design of having a stick on the left side for the captain and on the right side for the first officer. But they still use the yoke, and of course I learned to fly with a stick airplane, but the stick was between my legs and not off to the left or to the right as a co-pilot, a first officer. So, yeah, I think it has a lot to do with really flying, getting the feel of flying an airplane.
I totally agree. The tricycle gear, that makes a big difference too. But I know When I first started flying, I probably ground looped a couple airplanes real quick before I found out what those rudder pedals were for. And I don't know. That's just. I think that should be a problem.
I have some Boeing information too that maybe our listeners would like to hear about. That was released today.
And that is.
Is this another time?
Yeah, go ahead.
It is. Today Boeing unveiled the company's first ever full-size spacecraft. And it's similar to the Apollo capsule that took the U.S. to the moon in the 60s and the 70s. And it's called the CST-100. And it's a Hershey's kiss-shaped vehicle that can fly up to 7 astronauts into space. In demonstrations at Boeing Products Support Center in Houston, company officials strapped 2 astronauts into the spacecraft to give reporters a glimpse of what it might be like. And this is Boeing's Boeing like you've never seen Boeing before. The interior of the vehicle brings out the best of Boeing. The floor and what we call the seat struts and the seat pallet is where the seats sit. Were built by Boeing commercial airplane folks, and a Boeing CST-100 mechanical engineer told Collect Space, adding that while the mock-up's console was sourced from Bigelow, its display panels were provided by Boeing's St. Louis division. Now, the CST stands for the Crew Space Transportation, and more than 26,000-pound vehicle is meant to ride an Atlas V rocket to be launched into outer space. Boeing is currently in a race with several other companies for NASA's commercial crew program, including SpaceX, which has completed 2 round-trip cargo trips to the International Space Station with its vehicles and aims to certify its craft to carry human beings. NASA presently has no vehicles of its own for transporting human beings into space. Since the space shuttle program was retired, instead relying on a very pricey contract with Russia for all that capability. And the new contract is $663 million per seat, and a Boeing official told Fox News, the United States just signed another contract for 6 flights for over $70 million per seat. If we perform that business here in the States, we can do it for a lot less, he said. And Neil?
Well, I saw that picture. I didn't read the article, Steve, and thanks for bringing it to our listeners and to myself. But just seeing the interior of that capsule, I guess that's what I would call it. It looks like a capsule or, as you said, a Hershey's Kiss candy. How does it return to Earth? Does it return and with a splashdown in the Atlantic Ocean?
That's my understanding, to splash down, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, Jim, you said, Jim Graybill, you said you had some additional information about the 747s. Want to tell us about that?
Yeah, Neil, I just accidentally ran across this on a computer the other day. The 747 cargo, which they're now calling the Dream Lifter, well, you guys all know what the Guppy looked like. Well, you just about quadruple that size of that thing, and that's what this 747 Dream Lifter looks like. It's a huge, absolutely huge, big ball on top of this thing. And when you look at the 7-4, you know how big that airplane looks to the passenger. Well, before you look at this 7-4 Dream Lifter. I understand from what I've been able to pick up on this thing, they've built 4 of them, and the main reason for it is that Boeing has this contracts all over the world for the 787, and this Dream Lifter is going to fly all these parts, including built fuselages, built wings, and so forth. Back out to Everett, Washington to put them together. Just some numbers real quick here. This Dream Lifter is 235 feet 2 inches in length, and the 747-400 is 231. It's got a wingspan of 211 feet. It's got four, well, right now I guess there are GE engines that are right at 65,000 pounds of thrust. And speaking of engines, I understand that the 787 and maybe the 777, they're already flying a twin-engine airplane at thrust on those engines at right at 98,000 pounds, and they're pushing to go over 100,000 pounds.
Wow.
Won't that be a,
awesome.
A vacuum
awesome.
Cleaner going down the runway?
You have a fighter plane pretty soon.
Isn't that the truth?
Did it say weight in that article, Jim?
Yeah, the Dreamlifter, let me see if I can find it here. I underlined a whole bunch of numbers. Wingspan, height, fuselage. Max takeoff gross weight is 803,000 pounds. And the 747-400 is 875,000 pounds. The three engines, or the four engines are growing on that Dreamlifter, the Pratt & Whitney 4062. The GE engine and Rolls-Royce. But the GE engine seems to be the most powerful, 63,300 pounds thrust on that thing.
Yeah, four of them. Wow. You know, occasionally Boeing 747s have been used as biplanes.
They've been used as what, Neil?
Biplanes.
Oh,
you know what a biplane is?
Yeah, I think that one you had.
Well, the biplane I'm talking about is a Boeing 747 with the shuttle sitting on top of it.
I know what you're talking about now.
Yeah, what a versatile airplane 7-4 has been.
But that they call it the Dreamlifter. You really got to look at the cockpit to even recognize it's a 747. But that bubble that goes on the top of that 747, it's taller and wider than the 747 itself.
Wow,
it's a huge huge thing.
I'll have to go to the internet and take a look at that. I haven't seen the Dreamlifter.
Yeah, it's the first time I heard of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, the last one was they started building. Well, they built three up from 04 to 07, and then they decided, according to this article, they were going to build a fourth one. And they just completed it in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just
very good.
I had a chance to ride in the jump seat on the 744-400, and those two guys sitting up there, they are busier than a one armed paper hanger and a butt kicking top tail. You know what?
I had a chance to fly up in the cockpit also over to Hawaii on the freighter. And interesting, very interesting. Chuck, tell us a little about the maintenance stuff here. I think you mentioned the fact that you've been inside a wing tank. Is that what you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I'm just changing the subject just a little bit, kind of Chucky's corner here for maintenance. A lot of people don't know this, but some planes were early designed. They had rubber bladders inside the tanks to hold fuel. But as time went along, they made what they call wet wings, and that was they sealed the inside portion of the wings, and they pumped fuel in them. And today, that's where most most of the big airliners have wet wings in them today. And one of the things that I did as a mechanic in my early days, I worked for Pan Am, is to go in and do all the plumbing inside the wings of an airplane. That's these big pipes. They're like 2 inches in diameter, and they run the length of the wing. And, of course, there's wing tanks, and then there's fuselage tanks. And fuselage tanks are two big boxes underneath the passenger compartment, basically. And they pump fuel into that, and then they, of course, they pump fuel out. The thing about working on fuel tanks is underneath the wings, they have these little manhole covers, and they're just about as big as the average-sized man's shoulder, probably 18, 20 inches or something in an oval shape. And there's probably a dozen of them on each wing, and then there's some underneath the airplane. But one of the unique things about them, as you get out to the outer portion of the wing, of course, the tank gets smaller. And you have to get these tubes out for the sheet metal people to what they call buck rivets. That's to put a rivet in on the top and with a riveting gun. And a guy with a piece of block metal, he would hold the bottom of that rivet, and they would smash the rivet and bring the two metal portions together to make a seal. Well, to do that, you have to take all this plumbing pipe out. And on the outer side, I'm 6'1", and I'm a pretty big guy, even back when I was back in those days. And when you get into the outer wing tank, at the very end, it's like sitting in a little coffin trying to work with wrenches and everything. And as you go towards the lodge, of course, it gets bigger. And up next to the box in the airplane, you can actually kind of stand up in it, even being 6'1". But one of the unique things was when the 747 was originally concepted, Boeing come up with this idea that they went around the country and they hired little people from carnivals and circuses and stuff to come work for them as mechanics. And what they could do is they could stand up inside the wings of a 747, and they would do the sheet metal bucking and putting these pipes and stuff in. And they are there today building those new big planes, and they are classified as sheet metal mechanics. And one of the guys that I know that work with them, he says, you ought to hear them. You can hear them running around inside the airplane like little mice doing all their work. And it's kind of comical, but they do an excellent job. And that's kind of what Fuel Tank 101 is today. And as we go along, maybe in the next weeks or so, I can bring up some more maintenance things that maybe people are interested in that don't know about. But
very good.
Fuel tanks are pretty important.
You better believe it. There are a lot of them in a commercial airliner. George,
another
Jen,
thing, Neil,
our,
I found out about about Boeing. You all have heard Bob Black Sheep about Pepe Boeington.
Sure.
He graduated from University of Washington before he ever went to NAVCAD for flight training, and he worked for Boeing on a B-17 out there before he ever could start flight school. Said Boeing had two engineers and one draftsman when he went to work for him.
My golly.
I was reading some of his autobiography today, and
it's interesting. Yeah. George Jen is one of our radio show hosts, and George just had to go fishing today because he had a full moon up in New England. I guess it's a full moon down here in Florida, too. And he says you can catch fish when the moon is full. So he's out fishing, and George, I know you're not listening to this, but you did send me some email that I'd like to read in your absence, and I think it's a very good article. I guess he got it off the Internet somewhere, but it's titled Real Men Flew the Boeing 707, 727, and the Douglas DC-8s, and it goes like this. When you heard... Yes, sir, Captain, from dispatch, flight service, ground service, maintenance, your co-pilot did not carry FAA get-out-of-jail forms, and chief pilots had grand balls. Those were the good old days. Pilots back then were men that didn't want to be women or girly men. Pilots all knew who Jimmy Doolittle was. Pilots drank coffee, whiskey, smoked cigars, and didn't wear digital watches. They carried their own suitcases and brain bags like the real men that they were. Pilots didn't bend over into the crash position multiple times each day in front of the passengers at security so that some government agent could probe for tweezers or fingernail clippers or too much toothpaste. Pilots did not go through the terminal impersonating a caddy pulling a bunch of golf clubs, computers, guitars, and feed bags full of tofu and granola on a sissy trailer with no hat and granny glasses hanging on a pink string around their pencil neck while talking to their personal trainer on the cell phone. Being an airline captain was as good as being the king in a Mel Brooks movie. All the stewardesses, also known as flight attendants, were young, attractive, single women that were proud to be combatants in the sexual revolution. They didn't have to turn sideways, grease up, and suck it in to get through the cockpit door. They would blush and say thank you when told they looked good, instead of filing a sexual harassment claim. Junior stewardesses shared a room and talked about men with no thoughts of substitution. Passengers wore nice clothes and were polite. They could speak and understand English. They didn't speak gibberish or listen to loud gangsta rap on their iPods. They bathed and didn't smell like a rotten pile of garbage in a jogging suit and flip-flops. Children didn't travel alone, commuting between trailer parks. There were no monogal hordes, whatever that word pronounced it should be, asking for a friggin' seatbelt extension or a scotch and grapefruit juice cocktail with a twist. If the captain wanted to throw some offensive ranting jerk off the airplane, it was done without any worries of a lawsuit or getting fired. Axial flow engines crackled with the sound of freedom and left an impressive black smoke trail like a locomotive burning soft coal. Jet fuel was cheap, and once the throttles were pushed up, they were left there. After all, it was a jet age, and the idea was to go fast, run like a lizard on a hardwood floor. Economy cruise was something in the performance book, but no one knew why or where it was. When the clocker went off, no one got all tight and scared because Douglas built it out of iron. Nothing was going to fall off, and that sound had the same effect on real pilots then as Viagra does now for those new age guys. There are very little plastic and no composites on the airplanes or the stewardesses' pectoral regions. Airplanes and women had eye-pleasing symmetrical curves, not a bunch of ugly vortex generators, ventral fins, winglets, flow diverters, tattoos, rings in their nose, tongues, and eyebrows. Airlines were run by men like Howard Hughes and Juan Tripp, who had built their companies virtually from scratch, knew many of their employees by name, and were lifetime airline employees themselves, not pseudo-financiers and bean counters who flit from one occupation to another for a few bucks, a better parachute, or a fancier title, while fervently believing that they are a class of beings unto themselves. And so it was back then, and never will be again. You know, wow, what a lot of truth in that. What do you guys think?
Boy, you got that part right, Neil.
Sure miss those days.
Amen.
I dream about them all the time, though. Yeah.
It was an age that when the aviation industry, the flying public, just felt awe about it every time they saw a plane take off the ground.
Yeah. And it was nice to go out to the airport to fly even as a pass rider, because most of the people along with those that were flying on passes were well-dressed people.
Well, the bus station has moved to the airport now.
Yeah, you're right. I'll never forget flying the Moonlight Special on the A300 out in Houston, where we connected east and west with the other flights continuing to destinations. I don't know if you or Jim, you or Steve had the pleasure of flying those flights, but it was quite a change from the days of old when people dressed up, because these people were literally lying on the floor waiting to be awakened and put on the airplane. It was more of a cattle car operation up above. The cargo was a more respectable money-making product than the passengers above, because they were Greyhound rejects, in most cases, going somewhere for $49.
Yeah, I remember it well.
Yeah. Matter of fact, I had one guy that was completely bombed on the floor, and the agent was trying to awaken him. I said, no, just leave him there. He's not going on my airplane. And we
That's
left
right.
him. And I don't know where he wound up, but got just about out of time, but I want to play one of my favorites here that we played last week, and we'll say something nice. And you older guys remember the person that sang this song.
It's so important to make someone happy. Make just one someone happy. Make just one heart-to-heart you. You sing to one smile that cheers you. One face that lights when it nears you. One girl, you're everything to. Fame, if you win it, comes and goes in a...
Jimmy Durante. Chuck, will you take us out?
I hope you enjoyed tonight's show, and we look forward to being with you again next week. Same time, same station, the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. Wish you a very successful week in whatever you do or to undertake to do. And remember, keep the blue sky up, have a safe airspeed, and plenty of altitude. Good night, Eastern family.
Good night, Eastern family.
Good night, Eastern.
Good night now, you guys.